The Protectors is back, and I'm going to keep saying this for at least another 10 episodes because I love being back. I love talking to different people, and today it's a very special episode. Jack spent a long time inside, outside of the clandestine service in the military, and he was a bona fide spy. Not every day you get to speak to a bona fide spy, but Jack has not only done fighter pilot, spy, but he also has an incredible book out called The Frenchman. So we're going to be talking about the book. We're going to be talking about Jack's background. And obviously, Jack's real name isn't Jack. So we're going to be talking about that kind of stuff. Clandestine world is very interesting. Jack, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jason. Thanks for having me.
You know, we've been, obviously, with the pause and everything, we've been kind of working on this podcast for a while. You know, you're still working in the industry. You're still doing a lot of different things out there, and schedules sometimes don't marry up, right? But we're finally sitting here, continents away. I love this.
Finally.
Now, Jack.
Two different time slots, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. You know, the greatest thing about podcasts is trying to figure out time zones. And if anybody knows me, math and hours and trying to figure out times, not a good thing.
Hey, yeah, Jack, no, Katie, we have, I think we have 14 hours difference at the moment. So, yeah. So,
yeah, because you're in Australia, man.
Yeah, you're in summer and I'm in winter.
Jeez, man, this is awesome. Hey, Jack, you know, growing up, did you want to be a fighter pilot? I mean, was that kind of your thing, a pilot? And you're like, hey, you know what? I'm just going to do it.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's, you know how sometimes you carry on your shoulders the lineage of your family as well? And so with my real name, my ancestor was one of the main general of Napoleon, and my grandfather was one of the first free French forces to join De Gaulle in London in 1940, and he was one of the few French guys actually who did the D-Day in Normandy with the in Omaha Beach with the American forces, and he was the first French guy to enter the Eagle Nest in Berchtesgaden in the house of Hitler. And so he, basically, my parents were fighting quite a lot when I was a kid, and he basically raised me partially. And so I was, raised with this culture of the military in a way. And this house was actually in the middle of the countryside, and the fighter jets were flying over his house every day. And so I was looking at the fighter jets, and I think, wow, that's what I want to do. I want to become a fighter pilot. And if I can't, I want to be a Navy SEAL or spy. So, yeah, that's what happened.
So the French have the equivalent of the Navy SEALs as well?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Commando Marine. Yeah.
Yeah, we're going to have to get into the different, nomenclatures and, especially when it comes to the spy world. But, being a pilot's not easy. You have to have technical acuity and all sorts of other different things. So, obviously, you get into that and you're doing good. But then your career, this adrenaline-fueled career, is kind of cut short. What happens after that point?
Well, so I was flying, single-seaters for dogfight. So the equivalent of the F-16, basically, which is called the Mirage 2000. And I had a flying accident. I injured my back. So I couldn't eject. So I had the accident with the plane. It took the firemen a bit more than 2 hours to take me out of the canopy. And so I had to stop flying ejection seats. And I was retrained as a military pilot for special forces. So I was sent again deployed again in the Balkans to do the hunt of the Serbian war criminals, Mladic and Milosevic, for 2 years. It was good fun. I mean, flying lower than the trees with night vision goggles and landing on roads, on fields, this kind of stuff was good fun. And so I did this for 2 years. And actually, the guys I was transporting were either special forces or French external secret service. And so they became mates. And after 2 years, I had a survival training in the Alps, in the high altitude mountain, because I was meant to go and do the same in Afghanistan for Bin Laden at that time. My back broke again when I was digging my igloo. and I had one disc popping out again of the spine. And so I had to stop flying in the military, and I was a bit lost. And then those guys who became mates told me, why don't you try to join us? And it looked sexy and rock and roll, so I said yes. And I did the test, which is 1 year test. And then I was selected, and internally selected then to be on the field. Because normally when you join like this, automatically, I don't know if it's the same in CIA, but you go as an analyst. When you are recruited as a military man from the outside. And then internally, you can do the test to join the operational division, which is the field operative guys. And so I was selected, and I did 8 years of clandestine operations in various shitty countries to do some very seedy stuff. Yeah.
The city's not easy, and we'll get into that in a minute. But now I can, reading your bio, it's tough to find a lot out about you because of the nature of your past. But trying to figure out how you went from point A to point B to point C, and point B being you're working with the special forces, a lot of people don't realize that when you look at the special forces, they do work with the clandestine services a lot, especially with the global war on terrorism. And especially a lot of people don't realize, like in the 1990s, there was a massive flow of special forces and clandestine services in and outside of the Balkans from all the different countries. And when you bring up the war criminals and the hunt for the war criminals back then, this was pre 9/11. So this was where the action was. There was a lot of action in the Balkans back then. So that must have been, flying those clandestine operations. And people don't realize, like, some of the first POWs we had since, Vietnam War for us happened during that time frame. So there was a lot of action going on, especially for the flying community. So that must have been kind of, even though you're out of the fighter pilot genre, you're into the clandestine special forces flying, that must have been very hair raising back then.
Yeah, it was to be honest, it was a lot of fun, I have to say. It was good times. I've got some, crazy stories, landing in Sarajevo by night. The tower was closed. The airport was closed, like 20 centimeters of snow on the runway. I still continue to believe that I landed on the taxiway. But then we were taken in a car with the local services with who we had a meeting. And the general I was transporting, who was one of the bosses of the intelligence, had to negotiate with the Serbian, services, basically positions of where those criminals were. And he said to me just before, he said, so you're going to come with me on this one. And actually what they don't know, those guys, is that I speak Serbian. So for the last four or five years, I understand everything they say, but they don't know it. And today I'm going to tell them that I speak Serbian, so they might not react really well, and we might have to leave very shortly. So yeah, this kind of anecdotes was good fun.
I'd love to be a fly on a wall on some of these missions, especially back then. Because like as someone who I was in the military in the 90s, and then I was in the military post 9/11, so it's a lot of different culture. So yeah. when you jump into this spy world, and the spy world, you and I were talking a little bit before we hit the record button. The spy world is a lot different than what people think. You have the Jason Bournes, you have the James Bonds and everything. But the reality is a lot of it is keeping your cover and keeping cool when people are asking you questions. That means not getting flushed. That means being able to have conversations with people and blending in. You could look like a rock star when you're working with the special forces and stuff, but like when you said you're working in a city, you got to blend in. So coming from this structured military world, and thank God you went into the special forces because you can kind of get a little relaxed. We know how that is. But then you get into the clandestine world, and now, you have to shed your identity of being in the military. That must have been a really interesting, first step into the, your first operational step must have been very interesting.
Yeah, it's very, as you just said, it's very different when you are in uniform or when you are in the, classic military. The threat is a very direct threat. You can identify the threat. You know that some guy's going to try to you know, shoot you, and people are trying to kill you directly because you are in uniform. And but when you come back and when the mission is over, then you are, you have your holidays, you have your weekends, you have, you know, and so the threat stops, and so you can rest your brain and you can rest your body. But in the intelligence, so I was having five different IDs all the time, so I was playing on those five different IDs. And so then you have to come back home and be a father and a husband and go back to your real yourself, your real ID. And you end up realizing that actually it just becomes an additional sixth ID. And you just play a game. You just play the husband and play the dad. And it's very hard to not lose yourself and to still remember who you really are. And so there is a very heavy toll, psychological toll in the intelligence, because there are no weekends, no holidays. The threat can come. It's a very indirect threat, and it can come anytime, anywhere, even on the weekends or on holidays. And so it just never stops. That's why it's very, very heavy. And, you know, you have to do some very dark things, because you can't fight the devil by being an angel. So you have to be yourself with the same methodologies and a devil yourself. And you end up, you know, looking at yourself in the mirror and one morning, and you realize that actually this, you know, in the yin and yang part, the dark side is much, much bigger than it used to be, and actually a bit too big. And the white part almost disappeared. This is a heavy psychological, you know, toll to pay.
That was a great analogy, because, you know, you think about the military concept of like everything's pretty much black and white. You know who the enemy is. Well, at least in conventional wars you do, and sometimes later on with the GWAT wars and a lot of other places, you don't understand it. But then when you get into this world where, you know, three or four of your different identities are completely white, you know, you're living a day to day, but then you have the ones where you have to get into these organizations or develop sources or, you know, get into the weeds, you kind of start growing from white to gray, and you're teetering on the black. So It is, as you said, you have to, then you have to come home and put this facade on with your family, who has no idea what you're going through or what your life is like, because they live in a very vanilla world most of the time.
Yeah. And good on them. I mean, that's why we're doing this job. It's so that some people can live in this vanilla world and don't have to worry about it too much. And that's why you have guys like us. And so it's very, as you were saying, I mean, you can, in the intelligence, you can some days play the homeless guy, and some days I have to talk to some ministers. You know, so you have to adapt, you have to blend, you have to really be different. So it's really an actor game, kind of. It's really hard to remember who you are at the end of the day sometimes, because sometimes the false identity you have to play can be much more appealing than the real life, you know. So a lot of guys, I mean, that's in the French intelligence, in the DGSE, that's the way you have the highest rate of suicide and divorce in the whole French armed forces.
And that's one thing, I say this, that's one thing a lot, but there's a ton when it comes to like the different types of spy agencies and stuff like that, is suicide, is depression, is PTSD. A lot of spies go through the same things as soldiers do, because they're doing the same experiences. They're having the same experiences. Yeah. It may look on the outside world like it's a sexy machine, but then when you get into it, you're in firefights. You're in these zones where you don't know if someone's going to come behind you and kill you. You don't know if your cover is going to be blown. You don't know if your family is going to be compromised. And this stress on top of you, and you'll never know how many people commit suicide because of national secrets or something along those lines.
Yeah. And it's very, what you were just saying is very important. Is, I mean, all of us, you and me, we are trained to basically mentally be prepared to lose our life. But when it comes to your family, it's a different story. When you know that the bad guys in front of you will try to basically leverage you by approaching your family and identifying your family, And that's why we have false identities. It's not just to be, you know, James Bond arriving in the lobby of the hotel and say, my name is Bond. We have false identities because we need to protect our families, because that's the worst which could happen. And that's why I originally wrote this book. I wrote the book very selfishly for a very cathartic process, because I had the PTSD and I was, walking around my house at 2 a.m. with a knife in the dark, checking every door, every window and everything, and then sitting on the couch for 2 hours looking at the main door. Because I did it to others. I was entering houses, and so of course, why would anyone else wouldn't do it to me, you know? I decided to write this book, The Frenchman, because it was really to unload and get rid of this PTSD. And I wrote it without thinking that it would be published one day, you know? And then a mate of mine here in Australia said, oh, you should go and talk to a publisher. And that's how it started.
I was going to ask you that, how this came about, because, and the other thing is, not only is it a legacy, and it's something for you, but it's going to be for your kids too. I mean, that's why a lot of us write a book for the first time. But you know, when you first said, hey, you know what, I'm going to write a book, how did you outline it? I mean, you obviously you have all these stories, you know, you're going to probably have to get it cleared through some sort of government agency, and you know, you're going to need some protagonists, you're going to need this, you're going to need that, but it's not easy just to sit down and write. What was your process like? And especially coming from your world, I mean, obviously in the Intel world, you got to write a lot of paper. I mean, you got to write a lot of reports, and you're always reporting something,
always.
But it's different. But now you have to write for someone to actually want to read it.
Yeah.
And that's one thing I love about reading books like yours, where people have the experience in the background and how they put that to paper. What was your process like for getting The Frenchman on paper?
Oh, look, it's, the beginning of the book was basically the main story, which really kept me awake at night. It was not a very nice story. And because basically, you know how it is in the intelligence, you have all the operational part of the intelligence. So we try to grab the document itself and the intelligence on a paper itself, or observe things or take pictures, follow people, etc. But a big part of it is humans and recruiting human sources and handling those sources. But the rule number one usually is, from the moment we enter someone's life, a source, and we start to recruit the source and manipulate the source, it will never end up well for this person, because from the moment we have the intelligence that we wanted to have, we want no one else to have it, we want no one else to know that we have it, and we want no one to know how we got it. So basically, this person has to disappear. So when it's bad guys, terrorists, you know, whatever, you don't really give a shit. But when it's good people who are just wrong place, wrong time, or for you, right place, right time, but for them, the opposite, then it's a bit more, you know, it's a bit harder. And so sometimes you really get close to some people who in another life, being yourself, could have become friends. They are really good people, but you have to betray them for the superior interest of the nation and for the purpose of grabbing this intelligence, which is critical. And so when it ends up badly for them, it's not always easy to accept. And so that's how I started to write this book, is because there was this story when this guy was actually a really good guy, and he was married with one kid, and his kid was roughly the same age as mine at that time. And there was a problem, and it didn't end up well for him. So I started to write this story basically, but as a novel, because I'm not allowed to tell the real story, the real country, the real people, etc. And then I kept going on and on and on another story. And then I mixed all those stories to make a novel. But what I really wanted to address is, it's not Jason Bourne. It's not James Bond. We are usually married with kids. 90% of us are married with kids, because you are hired because you're married, because they are looking for this mental stability. And if you're not married and you go in operations being someone else, you might end up with lots of girls on your knees and suitcases of cash. So you have to have something which is hooking you back and grounding you back in your country and in your real life. So that's why you have to be married when you join this. But then the company is forcing you to lead some actions which are basically going to threat your marriage. So it's chicken and egg stuff.
What a world, man. And you did this for a while too. It was like, yeah. How long were you in? 8, 10 years?
Eight. So normally you are on the field as an operative for 5 years max. I did 8.
And then you decided to take this next step, and now you're a bona fide author. Like bona fide. This is like the real deal too. It's like, yeah.
It was at least, it was good for me to write this book. It really helped having less PTSD. You were talking about the kids. It also helped me to basically communicate with my kids what I was doing before. You know, when the book came out, they still didn't know what I was doing before. In their minds, I was still I was a fighter pilot, and that's it. And so one morning, I grabbed them just before the book came out, and I said to them, "Look, this is what I used to do. I used to be a spy." And so one of them exploded in laughter, thinking I was making a joke, and the other one, the youngest one, started to cry. And I said, "Why are you crying?" And he said, "Because now the bad guys are gonna come after us and chase you and chase the family." And I said, "No, that's not possible." And I said, "Why?" And I said, "Because they're all dead." So that was not very nice, but just came out. So yeah, no, anyway, so now they know what I did.
Well, the dark humor comes out, and everybody that's been in the military or any time in this world knows that dark humor is how you cope with a lot of different things.
Exactly. Yeah.
So when are we going to see the Frenchman on a big screen or the small screen?
That's a very good question. Look, so I sold the rights Hollywood, actually. The producers are—it's quite funny. It's the two sons of John Le Carre, and the company is called Ink Factory. And Ink Factory are the one who made, the Night Manager, Little Drummer Girl, A Most Wanted Man, or Unknown with Liam Neeson. All those movies. The scriptwriter is Nick Pizzolatto. Who is an amazing guy. I really love him. He's really amazing. And he did True Detective, He did the TV series. Mm-hmm. He created True Detective. I went to Texas last year for a few days and spent those few days with him. And he's an amazing guy. I really, really love him. Yeah. So we'll see where it goes. Now we have to find, of course, actors and directors, and then we will go to the pitch to the platforms, and hopefully one of them will be interested. But Nick is an amazing writer, and I can tell you that what he did with the book, the pilot episode script, is just crazy. I wrote the book. And I was reading the script, and I was like, "Oh, what's going to happen?" So yeah, he got me. So yeah, he's very, very talented.
I love how they're turning a lot of books into like bona fide hits, and the small screen as well. It doesn't necessarily like the True Detective. Everything else is like thrown on Netflix, Hulu, or anything else like that. Is so cool to have a nice series too, because like a lot of times you can't get a whole book into 2.5 hours or 2 hours. Yeah, so I love seeing the series.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, Jack, you are always welcome back on the show. Everybody, make sure you pick up The Frenchman. Jack Beaumont. Is it Beaumont?
Beaumont. Yeah.
My friend said, "Hey, you should do the interview in French." And I'm like, bro, I can't speak
French?
No, if I did, I would. Okay, Jack, I appreciate you coming on.
Thanks a lot, Jason. Thanks a lot for having me. 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 Thanks a lot for having me.